This morning, I'd like to read and talk about the Diamond Sutra. As you know, the Diamond Sutra is one of the Prajnaparamita Sutras, and the Prajnaparamita Sutras are the basis of our Zen practice. Indeed, unless one has worked thoroughly with the Prajnaparamita Hridaya and the Diamond Sutra, one is not really able to practice Zen. There is a tendency to dismiss the sutras, to dismiss the whole background of Buddhism, and just take the Zazen as being what it's all about. And it is true that the heart of our practice is Zazen. But nevertheless, it is fed and nourished by the sutras, and above all by the Prajnaparamita sutras. This person wrote a book on the sutras, and we do recommend that you refer back to it from time to time in order to maintain, so to say, the roots within the tradition. We must not make the mistake that we can cut with all of our tradition and just dismiss it as so much tomfoolery or unnecessary and so on. It is true that we do have to cut off many of the accretions which have grown up as a consequence of it passing through the Japanese culture. And this person does want, as far as possible, to cleanse it for our purposes of its Zen, its Japanese associations, not because there is anything wrong at all with the Japanese Zen and the Japanese masters. Far from it. But we must realize that the real Zen that we can practice must be the Zen which is rooted in our Quebec and society. It is within this condition that we live now that we are going to find the truth. We do not have to go back into the past to find the truth, but we do need this sustenance that can come from the past. So the Diamond Sutra begins very dramatically. And it begins very dramatically because it is not any drama at all. Anybody that has read any of the sutras, the Huayan Sutra, for example, or the Lotus Sutra and so on, know all the bombast that goes into the beginning where Buddha is surrounded by 100,000 bodhisattvas and 10,000 mahasattvas and devas and the whole caboodle. This we don't need. It was necessary for the time in which it was brought up because it was a way by which the whole overwhelmingness of Buddhism could be demonstrated. The sort of the sheer massiveness, the sheer radicalness of Buddhism could be shown. And unfortunately, many of us don't realize just how radical Buddhism really is, just how far-reaching, how profound the teaching is. Most of us look around and all we're interested in is whether our knees ache or whether we're getting anywhere and this kind of stuff. But unfortunately, nowadays, we're bombarded all the time with the outrages, with the overwhelming, with the massive and so on. And so therefore, this beginning is most apposite for our time. One day at breakfast time, the world-honoured one put on his robe and, carrying his bowl, made his way into the great city of Sravasti to beg for his food. In the midst of the city, he begged from door to door according to the rule. This done, he returned to his retreat and ate his meal. When he had finished, he put away his robe and begging bowl, washed his feet, arranged his seat, and sat down. The utter simplicity of that, the utter lack of bombast. If one can enter into this, the sheer humility of the whole account, this is the world-honoured one, and yet this is an old man going about his daily routine. And it is that old man going about his daily routine that is our teacher. As long as we have Buddha up there, exalted, on a throne, flashing a radiant light from here to there, in the midst of many cosmoses and so on, it is out of our reach. One is lost in sort of awe, in wonder perhaps, but at the same time, what good is it to me? But then there is this old man, and as a consequence, we can really be acquainted with him, close to him. We can enter into his world in a very direct and complete way. When you read the Diamond Sutra, don't skip the beginning. Dwell on the beginning. Dwell on what it is saying. And the Subhuti asks, world-honoured one, if people want complete awakening, how should they control their thoughts? And he says, Bodhisattvas should discipline their thoughts thus. All living beings are caused by me to attain unbounded liberation, nirvana. What does he mean by that? Who is this me that assures us of complete liberation? What is that me? This is the Tathagata. The Tathagata liberates us. And again, what does that mean? It doesn't mean what the Christians mean when they talk about Jesus saving us. When Jesus saves us, there is that man over there, the Jesus, the man, and he, the man, has, by sacrificing himself on the cross, saved us in our sins. Doesn't matter what that really means, but there you see that kind of idea. But this is not it. This me of Buddha is me of the Tathagata. And the only way that you're going to encounter me, the Tathagata, is through the utter simplicity which this opening of the Diamond Sutra introduces us to. And as we say, we've said it ad nauseum now, this is just allowing what is to be. When you do that, then the Tathagata is with you. The Tathagata is you. All living beings are caused by me to attain unbounded liberation, nirvana. Yet, when vast, innumerable, immeasurable numbers of beings have been liberated, not one has been liberated. Why is this? Because no bodhisattva who is a real bodhisattva cherishes the idea of an ego entity, a personality, a being, or a separate individuality. Now, of course, this is nothing new to you. In fact, it is now, you've heard it so many times that you can just dismiss it and get on with your normal way of dreaming. But listen to what it says. No one is liberated. Not one being has been liberated. He liberates innumerable number of beings, but no one has been liberated. And he says, why is this? He says, because there is no ego entity, personality, being, or separate personality. You're used to hearing this, and you've applied it to yourself. You're beginning to realize, perhaps, if there's anything in the work that you've been doing, or perhaps profoundly, that you are not something. It is no good ever reciting that to yourself in some belief that it's a kind of magic incantation which will bring you nearer the truth. It won't. But if you've really examined everything that you think you are from every angle, then it will gradually come to you that you're not even a shadow. It is not that you are absent, that you are, this is not an annihilation, this is not nihilistic teaching. But this need to cling to a limited sense of being means that this truth, that you encompass all that there is within your universe, that nothing is outside, that you contain all, is lost sight of. It is this open to all that is true liberation, and it is present for all of us, every moment. It is like that, except we're looking away. However, what is important in what Buddha is saying now is that there are no other people either. Listen, there are no other people either. You have populated your universe with all kinds of people, people that you like, people that you dislike, people who you say is your friend, people who are members of your family. And every one of them you have endowed with an ego, a personality, a being, or a separate individuality. But there is no other individual, separate individuality or being. One of the interesting things, of course, is you do it even to the cat or the dog that is your pet. People ask sometimes, what happens to my dog when he dies? And people really feel there is an entity in that dog or cat that is it, the essence of the cat. That is the cat. And they even see this person, a real person, they see it in an idol. If you were a girl and you were brought up in the traditional way, you'd have been given dolls. And you used to endow the dolls themselves with a personality. They were real for you for the time being. And as we have said many times, when you go to the cinema, those people up there are real for you during the length of the film. That's if it's any very good film. You see their personality. You know them as a person. This is particularly true, of course, of soap operas. People fall in love with characters in a soap opera. They get terribly upset, depressed sometimes, even to a pathological degree, because the soap opera people get into difficulties. Those soap opera characters are real to some people, like your aunt is real to you. Now, what is going on then? What is this? Once upon a time, the world was populated by gods, and they were real. They weren't imaginary. These people that worship gods were not mad. They did not have some idiotic feeling that they had to create. When Moses talked to God, he talked to God. He talked to someone. If you like, there is an interesting fellow, Julian Jaynes, that gives you some sort of explanation for this, but the explanation to me doesn't wash. But nevertheless, he gives convincing argument for the truth that people actually talk to gods. And there are still people, when a close member of the family dies, they still talk to them. So what is it? What is real here? Are you real? I'm not asking. When you say to somebody, you, what are you talking to? I've asked this before. I've asked this. Have you asked yourself about this? Because if you do, you'll see in that an opening to this profound mystery of being. Just see it. There are no people. There are no beings. There none of the cats, dogs, or whatever that you've ever known had a personality or being. You saw it as a personality. Now, when you see me, what do you see? When you talk to me, what do you talk to me? You create me in exactly the same way that you create yourself. That sense of self which you have is the sense of you. When you say you, it is the same as when you say me. Of course, overlaid that foundation of the sense of self, there are various nuances. It's interesting that when you think, say, of a friend, you think of that person, there's a certain quality that person has that no other person has in your memory. And you've got all of these people that you've encountered, and each one is given a kind of quality. They carry their own kind of being, and it is that which makes us feel they are individual and separate. But it's our feeling. This does not belong to the person themselves. Now, obviously, you are not a figment of my imagination, and I assure you, I am not a figment of yours. There is something that is real here. We're not dismissing it all and saying it is all unreal. But what is it then? Because if you can penetrate into that, you are penetrating into the same time the question, who am I? We have to break through this inertia which leads us to take everything for granted. This is the awful thing. And we take it for granted most often because we believe this is how it is and we believe that because other people have told us, one way or another, that this is how it is. Everybody in society agrees that there are individuals, there are separate persons, there are ego entities or whatever. Society, humanism that came up in the 17th century, turned this into a kind of religion. It is religious belief. This is the sort of the soul, the soul that God created. We cannot have abortions because the fetus has a soul which God created. No, God didn't create anything because there's no God to create it in the first place, but in the second place, there is no entity that has been created. There's an interesting, very interesting story with Basso. Basso went on a pilgrimage. You can read it if you're interested. It's a very, very good book, full of wonderful haiku. He's the most wonderful haiku writer, and if you like haiku, then, of course, this is your book. It's called Journeys to the Far North, and he starts off on his horse, and shortly after he starts his journey, he finds a baby in the hedgerow crying. So what does he do? He gets down, he looks at the baby for a while, he writes a haiku about the baby, he gets on his horse and he rides away. I mean, you tell that to a Christian and they'll blow their stack. Why is it that... Is Basso cruel? Is he hard-hearted? But if you read his haiku, he's a gentle, sensitive, real human being. Now, how can that be? Because we take it that anybody, they naturally consider the child and think, oh God, there's an entity there that is suffering. Well, I have to save that entity. But the way that Basso saw it was, it is simply within the stream of life. There is a karmic current going, and this is carrying this with it, that other people call a child, on its way. And this is really what haiku says. I can't exactly remember the words now, but it's words to that effect. Now, it is so foreign, so utterly foreign to our way of understanding that most people tend to reject it. I did tell, what do they call them, a pastor or something, a Christian priest or whatever. He wasn't a Catholic. I did tell him about this. It was a man who was always pumping on about Christianity. I must confess, I told it to him to shock him. And by, and by God, he was shocked. He wouldn't have had anything to do with me after that, hardly. He thought I was just absolutely out of this world. But you see, there is a genuine different way of seeing other people. And there's no doubt about it that although Japan has come up, so to say, into the enlightened age and now has ITV and iPhone and all the rest of it, so it's really civilized, and they are now getting into the sense of I, their society was built around an entirely different conception of what a human being was about, because it never went through the Renaissance. It never went through the Enlightenment period. It never had people writing about humanism and all the rest of it. I'm not saying humanism is bad. I'm just saying it is a way of seeing the world. It's neither good nor bad, any more than the view that Basso had or anybody else has is good or bad. It's a way of seeing the world. So what are you? And what are all these people around you? What is your friend or husband or lover or mother or father? Or what? Ask yourself about this now. Supposing there is no ego entity there, what is there then? What are you in the face of? And to do this, it really does mean there's a kind of stretching of the girders of the soul. There's a kind of opening that is really difficult because you keep on wanting to go back to that inert way. Well, that's how it is. And then there's a question, can the Tathagata be recognized by some material characteristic? Now, you can see this at two levels. One is, can you recognize a realized person by some material characteristic? Because, you know, there was, 32 marks of a Buddha. And this is really questioning this. But at the same time, it's Kensho. Does Kensho give you any way by which you separate out, you're different from others in such that others can identify it? Many people are practicing in order to get Kensho, in order that they will have at least something that separates them from others, something that is, if you like, a reward for the work they're doing. And he says, no, well-honored one, the Tathagata cannot be recognized by any material characteristic. None at all. You know, there was a story that some Buddhist saint, or whatever you might call it, highly developed, if you like to say, use those words, man. And all the birds recognized his spiritual attainment, and they all brought flowers and dropped them at his feet. And this man became very worried, and he was asking himself, where's gone wrong? Why? What have I done wrong? What is it that... And what he's asking is, why is it that this practice has not eliminated everything that distinguishes me from everything else? In other words, why is it that I cannot take my true place as the universe itself? And then he says, my teaching of the good law is to be likened unto a raft. The Dharma must be relinquished. How much so the Adama, you know, what all the other teachings. This is a very famous saying, and there are some people who say, well, therefore, you know, let's chuck it all out. I mean, Buddha himself has said it's it shouldn't be held on to. So why are we holding on to it? But you see, that's like somebody in the middle of the river rowing across on this raft saying, oh, well, it's only a raft, let's get rid of it. Wouldn't get very far, would they? No, the only time you get rid of it is when you've reached the other shore. It's the only time that when you really see that there is no thing, when you really see there is no person, there is no Dharma left anyway, there's nothing to give up. There is not now, okay, now I can give it up and let it go. But what Buddha is saying is this is the direction to go, not the direction by which one worships the scriptures and feels that there is something sacred about the writings and must be preserved. Then there's a very enigmatic statement which is very interesting, because it undercuts the very way that we think, particularly in the West, when he says the Tathagata declares that a world is not really a world, it is called a world. You see, you probably know that the logic of the West is based on the law of identity, that everything is what it is. And Buddha is saying, no, it isn't. It is called that, but that doesn't mean to say it is that. And this is the thing, that because we give things words, we give them, or appear to give them, endurance. We appear to give them something which can go on for the eternity. And this is particularly true when we come to talk about you and me. I is a word. That is all. It has nothing beyond of. It doesn't have any kind of substance. It is simply a word. It is simply a puff of air that makes a sound. But I, you can hear people sometimes when they use this word, they say, I, they never get the word out. It's so precious, it's so juicy, it's so succulent that they can't just let it go. And this is it. Have you spent a day not using the word I? Please do so. If you haven't done so, please do so. Please have the courage or the strength or whatever it takes. You'll find that it is an extremely long, boring, uninteresting day. And that is fascinating because it is not leavened periodically by that juicy word I. And you'll then see what part it plays in our lives. And you'll also realize, why am I spending so much time defending, protecting, nurturing, succoring this word, this sense of being? No wisdom can we get hold of, no highest perfection. There's no wisdom, no highest perfection. This, as it says here, when told of this, if not bewildered and in no way anxious, a bodhisattva courses in the Prajnaparamita. In other words, it is only when one has really seen into it that one can really say that and not be stressed out by it. Of course, there's a difference between saying it and really saying it. When you really realize this, there is no thing. There is no perfection. There is no ultimate attainment. There is no knowing. No being, no thing. When you really get into it, in the first instance, it's like looking into an awful chasm. And we shy away from it every time immediately. This is one of the things people say, they've got this profound fear, but they don't know what they're afraid of. Well, they're afraid of this chasm. They're beginning to taste the truth, and the truth is too terrible to bear. It's only too terrible to bear because we have devoted our lives to not seeing it, to turning our back constantly on it. And it's because of that, that when we start opening up, then one very often goes through periods, and sometimes long periods, of severe anxiety. It can be really awful. I remember when I used to have to drive a lot, and sometimes I'd be driving And I just get the feeling that the world is crumbling in front of me, because I was looking in there, I was seeing there's no thingness. And there was this sense, there was nothing, that I was driving into nothing, that the world was not... I had to stop the car periodically sometimes, just to recover. And the way I recovered, of course, was assuring myself that everything was normal. In other words, I'd pile back on all that I had been spending hours on the mat trying to see into and get beyond. It says, a bodhisattva courses in the Brajnaparamita. In form, in feeling, will, perception and consciousness, nowhere in them they find a place to rest. There is nowhere to rest. And again, this, above all, we want to rest. The most we can offer the dead is that they rest in peace. And we're constantly, no, look, let me stop for a while. Let me rest for a while. Just let me rest. All I want is rest for a while. How often have you felt that in your life? And this... Shakespeare, I think it was A Tempest, when he said, time must have a stop. That's it. Somewhere something has to stop, something has to come to a culmination, something has to end. Zen, it is looked upon as the last word of Zen. I've got to find the last word of Zen. I've got to get to that point at which I've arrived. I've made it. I can rest there. This is the sort of the ultimate drive in most of us. And what they're saying is there is no rest. There is no ultimate point of arrival. There is no ultimate realization, if you like, where you can say, I've done it at last. One of the great things about school was we was always having exams. All right, exams were a pain in the ass, but at the same time, they gave us a sense that we're going to achieve. And when we got our marks, we felt, we've got something. But of course, then a new semester would begin. But never mind, that was always, it was punctuated by periods of achievement or possible achievement. In life, there are no... You just get through one thing, and as you get through it, so another thing comes up. And then as you get... As someone said, life is just one damn thing after the other. If a bodhisattva practices charity with a mind attached to formal notions, she is like unto a person groping sightless in the gloom. But a bodhisattva who practices charity with mind detached from any formal notion is like a person with eyes open in the radiant glory of the morning, to whom all kinds of objects are clearly visible. Elsewhere, it says again that when you practice charity or when you help other people, you must realize there are no other people to help. And this is so important, because very often we feel, particularly in our Western society, that one of the ways that we can sort of progress along the spiritual path is by helping other people. Or very often it's just a feeling, I want to help other people. But if you are helping other people, and there are people that you feel you're really helping, then sooner or later you will feel superior to those people. You can't help it. You are in the driver's seat, the helper. They are in the receiver's seat, the helpless. And sooner or later, that kind of thing comes about. You see it very often in the medical profession, nurses and doctors. There's a certain superiority they have over you, because they genuinely want to help, but they see you as a person, And they're taught to see you as a person, of course, as an object. An object with all kinds of levers and pulleys that keep it going. But in any case, this notion of seeing other people as other people. No, you help people because you help people. If you do that, then there are no people that you help. That doesn't mean to say you do away with them. You're sort of you've got a blank space in front of you that you give food to. But this sense, I am helping others, it goes back to this, what I was saying right at the beginning. We must divest ourselves of this sense there are other people in the world. And of course, when people think about that with their minds, God, that would be lonely. Fancy living in a world in that's madness. No, because you are everybody else. You are your mother, you are your father, you are your lover, you are your enemy. It's not as though most religions see this in one way or another, when in Christianity everyone's my brother and sister. You are. This is it. But it's not you that which you think you are. It's not you, the personality, you, the sense of self. No, that sense of self, by definition, is individual, isolated, and unique for you. But that, the whole point is that this is not you. And you are not, again, an empty space either. Here is the wonderful, wonderful mystery. And because you fiddle around with all kinds of other things, you cannot get into this mystery, which is such a terrible shame. It is beautiful if you can allow it to be. There's another one which is also very worthwhile bearing in mind, very well bearing in mind. One who is reviled has transgressed in former lives, which doom him or her to fall into evil worlds. But because... Oh, I'm so sorry. Bear with me. Sorry. I'll start again so we get this, because it is really good. One who is reviled by others has transgressed in former lives, which doom him or her to fall into evil worlds. But because of the scorn and vilification by others in the present life, the transgression in former life are wiped out. You see, if somebody comes up and says, oh, who the hell do you think you are? Get out of it. You immediately turn around, what? Hey, who are you talking to? Immediately the bristles are up and the fangs come out. But this, the humiliation that we feel in the face of that insult is the sense that I, the unique one, is no longer unique. I, the unique one, has been dislodged from its throne. And when you're working on the tongue there, what are you trying to do? If you're sincere and if you're honest, you're trying to see into this shadow. And by doing that, you're naturally getting it off its throne. You're doing the very thing yourself that your enemy would do for you. So when your enemy comes up, or this person that doesn't like you, that is always on to you, that is bullying you or whatever, when they do their work, this is wonderful. They're doing the work for you. This is free. It's given to you without any kind of charge. On the contrary, There it is. There was a teacher, a Sufi teacher actually, that told his student to pay people to insult him. And he did so for 3 years, and the teacher said, okay, you needn't do that anymore. So this student went off, and he was about to go into a town. You know, they had gates in those days, and an old beggar would sit outside the gate. And everyone that went through, he'd curse, he'd insult in every possible way. And so, of course, when this student came and he goes to go through the gate, the old beggar goes to work and gives him a real roughing over. And the disciple laughs. He says, oh, thank you very much. He said, look, the last 3 years I've been paying for that. You see, let us look at this in future. If you've got somebody in the office, see that person, let them do it. Feel the pain, feel the scorn. It's not that this is a way of shielding you from it, on the contrary. But you see, as I say, you can spend hours and still not get that degree of erosion of the sense of self that comes in those few minutes.
Les quatre vœux.
Tous les êtres innombrables, je
les veux. Libérer les passions aveuglées enfin, je les voudrais. Les barrières infinies du dharma, je les voudrais franchir. La grande voie du Bouddha, je les voudrais. Tous les êtres innombrables, je fais vœu de libérer les passions aveugles enfin, je fais vœu de vaincre les barrières infinies du dharma, je fais vœu de franchir la grande voie du Bouddha, je fais vœu de l'atteindre. Tous les êtres innombrables, je fais vœu de libérer les passions aveuglées sans fin, je de vaincre les barrières infinies du dharma, je fais vœu de franchir la grande voie du Bouddha, je fais vœu de l'atteindre.